or so it seemed. And it has been among the true pleasures of my life. Night and light, silence and difficulty. It seemed to me always rigorous and good. I believe it was recommended to me by Edward, and also by my reverend grandfather, when he made his last flight into the wilderness. I may once have fancied myself such another tough old man, ready to dive into the ground and smolder away the time till judgment. Well, I am distracted from that project now. My present bewilderments are a new territory that make me doubt I have ever really been lost before. Though I must say, all this has given me a new glimpse of the ongoingness of the world. We fly, forgotten as a dream, certainly, leaving the forgetful world behind us to trample and mar and misplace everything we have ever cared for. That is just the way of it, and it is remarkable. Jack brought gourds, a whole sack of them. Your mother sent him back with green tomatoes. Oh, these late, strange riches of the summer, these slab-sided pumpkins and preposterous zucchinis. Every wind brings a hail of acorns against the roof. Still, it is mild. For a while, the spiders were building webs everywhere, and now those webs are all blown to shreds and tatters, so I suppose we can imagine well-fed spiders tucked up in the detritus of old leaves, drowsing away the very thought of toil. I remember once my father and my grandfather were sitting on the porch together, crackling and shelling black walnuts. They loved each other's company when they weren't at each other's throats, which meant when they were silent, as they were that day. My grandfather said, "The summer is ended, and still we are not saved." My father said, "That is the Lord's truth." Then silence again. They never looked up from their work. It was the drought they were speaking of, which had already set in and which would go on for years, a true calamity. I remember a sweet, soft wind like there is today. There is no work more tedious than shelling black walnuts, and the two of them did it every autumn of the world. My mother said they tasted like furniture, and I'm not sure anyone disagreed. But she always had them, so she used them. You and Tobias are on the porch steps, sorting gourds by size and color and shape, choosing favorites, assigning names. Some of them are submarines, and some of them tanks, and some of them are bombs. I suppose I should be expecting another visit from T's father shortly. All the children play at war now. All of them make those sounds of airplanes and bombs and crashing and exploding. We did the same things, playing at cannon fire and bayonet charges. There is certainly nothing in that fact to reassure. Cataract that this world is, it is remarkable to consider what does abide in it. I fell to thinking about a sermon my father gave after the breach with Edward had become known, and he had had a little while to reflect on it. It was not at all like him to refer to anything private or personal except in the most abstract terms. But that morning he thanked the Lord for letting him know finally in some small degree what defection was, for allowing him to understand what it was he himself had done to his father in those days after the war when he had gone off to the Quakers and left his father to carry his terrible burden alone. He said a thing I had never heard before, that his mother, though she had been too ill and in too much pain to come to church for months, did come when she learned that he was staying away. His sisters, who by then were always with her, carried her in their arms, one and then the other, up the road, which must have seemed very long to them. They were late, because it was only that morning their mother had asked them to bring her, and they were hot and unkempt with haste. Haste in the slow work of gentleness, because by then their mother could hardly bear to be touched. Their mother was white and shorn, much too small for the dress they had to ease her into with such painful care. They walked in the middle of the sermon in their wash dresses, sweaty and unbonneted, Amy, the eldest, carrying their mother in her arms as she might have carried a half-grown child. My father said the old reverend stopped preaching and stood looking at them, then took up his text again, which was about the profound mystery of suffering for others, as all his sermons were in those days. He preached a few minutes, and prayed a few minutes, and said the benediction, and then he went to his wife and took her up in his arms, and kissed her forehead, and carried her home, leaving his flock to the long Sabbath of the Methodists. I cannot describe the shame I felt, my father said. My sisters spoke to me about what my mother had done because they were afraid she might insist on going to church again if I stayed away again. Amy told me, "If you put us through that one more time, I will hate you till I die." And of course I did not. My father was telling himself and all the rest of us that Edward's transgressions were trivial beside his own. He was also saying to himself and to the rest of us that there was an aptness in this present embarrassment and disappointment which made it valuable and instructive to him, that there was a seeming design in it that might mark it, in fact, as the Lord's benevolence, a sort of parable meant to deepen his own understanding. This construction of the matter would certainly have forbidden, or at least discouraged, any impulse he might have felt to blame Edward. The thoughtlessness of any individual, when it is seen to be in service of the mindfulness of the Lord, cannot justify anger. I have used this line of reasoning any number of times myself, when I have felt the need and found the occasion. And the fact is, it is seldom, indeed, that any wrong one suffers is not thoroughly foreshadowed by wrongs one has done. That said, it has never been clear to me how much this realization helps when it comes to the practical difficulty of controlling anger. Nor have I found any way to apply it to present circumstance, though I have not yet abandoned the effort. This afternoon I came back from a fairly discouraging meeting at the church. Just a few people came, and absolutely nothing was accomplished. That is the kind of thing that wears me out. So I took a nap and slept through supper. It was dark when I woke up, and the house was empty, so I went out to the porch. You and your mother were sitting on the swing, wrapped up in a quilt. She said, "This might be the last mild night." She made room for me beside her and spread the quilt across my lap and rested her head on my shoulder. It was just as pleasant as could be. This summer she planted what she calls her owl garden, I being the owl in question. She read somewhere that white flowers are most fragrant at night, so she planted every white flower she could think of along the front walk. Now there are just a few roses left, and alyssum and petunias. So we sat there in the dark together for a while, you asleep, more or less, with your mother stroking your hair. Then we heard footsteps in the road, and sure enough, it was Jack Boughton. I believe he may have meant to say good evening and pass by, but your mother asked him to come visit a little, so he did. He came in the gate and sat down on the steps. I have noticed that toward her he is consistently obliging. "We were just enjoying the quiet," she said. He said, "No better place in the world to do that." Then, as though he was afraid he might be misunderstood, or at any rate that he might give offense, he said, "It really is good to be back for a while." He laughed. "There are people here now who don't know me from Adam. It's wonderful." Then he put his hand to his face, his eyes. It was dark, but I could recognize that gesture. He has made it his whole life, I believe. I said, "It has been a great happiness to your father having you here." He said, "The man's a saint." "That might be true, but it was still good of you to come. Ah, he said, as a man might when a chasm has opened at his feet. So there was a silence of a few minutes, and then your mother stood up and lifted you out of the quilt and carried you away to bed. I have been glad to see you too, I said, because I really was, for old Boughton's sake. To that he made no reply. I say that quite sincerely. He stretched out his legs and leaned back against the porch pillar. No doubt, he said. Stack of Bibles? He laughed. How high? A cubit or so. That'll do, I guess. Would 2 cubits put your mind at ease? Entirely. And then, remembering his manners, it has been good seeing you again, and meeting your wife, your family. Then we were quiet for a while. I said, I'm impressed that you know Karl Barth. Oh, he said, from time to time I try to crack the code. Well, I said, I admire your tenacity. He said, you might not if you understood my motives. Of all people on this earth, he must be the hardest one to have a conversation with. So I said, that's all right, I admire it anyway. And he said, thanks. So we were just quiet there for some time. Your mother came out with a pot of hot cider and cups, and she sat there quiet right along with us, the dear woman. And I spent the time thinking how it would be if Jack Boughton were indeed my son, and had come home weary from whatever life he had, and was sitting there still and at seeming peace in that peaceful night. There was a considerable satisfaction in that thought. The idea of grace had been so much on my mind, grace as a sort of ecstatic fire that takes things down to essentials. There in the dark and the quiet, I felt I could forget all the tedious particulars and just feel the presence of his mortal and immortal being. And a sensation came over me, a sort of lovely fear that made me think of Boughton's fear of angels. Now, I may have been more than half asleep at that point, but a thought arose that abides with me. I wish I could sit at the feet of that eternal soul and learn. He did then seem to me the angel of himself, brooding over the mysteries his mortal life describes, the deep things of man. And of course, that is exactly what he is. For who among men knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of the man which is in him? In every important way we are such secrets from each other, and I do believe that there is a separate language in each of us. Also a separate aesthetics, and a separate jurisprudence. Every single one of us is a little civilization built on the ruins of any number of preceding civilizations, but with our own variant notions of what is beautiful and what is acceptable, which, I hasten to add, we generally do not satisfy, and by which we struggle to live. We take fortuitous resemblances among us to be actual likeness, because those around us have also fallen heir to the same customs, trade in the same coin, acknowledge more or less the same notions of decency and sanity. But all that really just allows us to coexist with the inviolable, untransversible, and utterly vast spaces between us. Maybe I should have said we are like planets. But then I would have lost some of the point of saying that we are like civilizations. The planets may all have been sloughed from the same star, but still the historical dimension is missing from that simile. And it is true that we all do live in the ruins of the lives of other generations, so there is a seeming continuity, which is important because it deceives us. I am old enough to remember when we used to go out in the brush, a lot of us, and spread out in a circle, and then close in, scaring the rabbits along in front of us, till they were trapped there in the center, and then we would kill them with sticks and clubs. That was during the Depression, and people were hungry, and we did what we could. I'm not finding fault. We didn't take the jackrabbits, only the cottontails. We all knew there was something objectionable about jackrabbits, though I don't remember anyone saying just what it was. There were people eating groundhogs. The children would go to school with nothing in their lunch buckets but a boiled potato or a scrap of bread with lard smeared on it. In those days, the windows of the church used to get so pelted with dust that I'd get up on a ladder and sweep them down with a broom so there would be light enough inside for people to read their hymnals. The times were dreadful, but it was just how it was, and we got very used to it. That was our civilization, the Valley of the Shadow, and it might as well be Ur of the Chaldees, for all people know about it now. For which I thank God, of course, though since it had to happen, I don't regret having been here for it. It gives you another look at things. I have heard people say it taught them there is more to life than security and the material comforts. But I know a lot of older people around here who can hardly bear to part with a nickel, remembering those hard times. I can't blame them for it, though it has meant that the church is just now beginning to come out of its own depression. There is that scattereth and increaseth yet more, and there is that withholdeth more than is meet, but it tendeth only to want. Much in this very town proves the truth of that proverb. Well, the church is shabby for the same reason it's still standing at all, so I shouldn't really complain. It is a good thing to know what it is to be poor, and a better thing if you can do it in company. I believe they thought I had nodded off, as I do with fair frequency, I know. They began to talk. Your mother said, in a lowered voice, "Have you decided how long you will be staying here?" He said, "I'm afraid it's already begun to seem long, not to me so much." There was a silence, and then she said, "You'll be going back to St. Louis?" "That's possible." Another silence. He struck a match. I could smell the smoke of a cigarette. "Would you care for one?" "No, thank you," she laughed. "Sure I would. It just isn't seemly in a preacher's wife." "It just isn't seemly. I guess they've been after you." "I don't mind," she said. "Somebody had to tell me a few things sooner or later. Now I've been seemly so long, I'm almost beginning to like it." He laughed. She said, "It did take me a while to get used to this place. That's a fact." "Well, for me, that's not a problem. It feels familiar to me, all right. It feels a little like returning to the scene of the crime." After a moment, she said, "Everybody speaks about you very kindly, you know." "Really? Interesting. I suppose I believe you." She laughed. "I haven't lied in years." That sounds exhausting." "They say you can get used to anything." He said, "Reverend Ames still hasn't warned you about me?" She found my hand and took it between her two warm hands. "He don't speak unkindly. He never does." There was a silence. I was fairly uncomfortable with myself, as you can imagine, and I was about to show some signs of stirring just to extricate myself from this discreditable situation I had put myself into, which seemed almost to be spying. "But your mother said..." "I was in St. Louis once. Some of us went there looking for work." She laughed. "No luck." He said, "It's a miserable place to be broke." "If there's a good place to be broke, I sure never found it, and I tried them all." They laughed. He said, "When I was young, I thought a settled life was what happened to you if you weren't careful." She said, "I always knew better than that. It was the one thing I wanted. I used to look in people's windows at night and wonder what it was like." He laughed. "That's how I was planning to spend this very evening." There was a silence. "Well," she said, and her voice was very gentle. "Well, Jack, bless your heart." And he said, "Why, I thank you for that, Lila." Then he stood up. "Tell the Reverend good night for me," and he went away. I lay awake the whole night, except for the part of it I spent sitting at my desk writing all this out and thinking it over. Of course, I was touched by your mother's pride in my tendency to avoid speaking evil. It is something I do, in fact, try to avoid, though you know very well what a struggle it has been for me in this case. But I could only be struck by young Boughton's amazement that I had not yet, in his words, warned her about him. It was almost as though he thought I had been negligent. And who would be a better judge of that than he is? He might think I know things I don't know, assuming Boughton confided in me more than he ever did, or that talk about him would have reached me, as in fact it did only rarely. I always suspected people of a good deal of tact where he was concerned. The scene of the crime. That was a joke, I'm pretty sure, but it does lead me to wonder how much of the misery I feel in him comes from the fact that he is here, where things went on that still might cause him suffering, maybe shame. I wish I could put my hand on his brow and calm away all the guilt and regret that is exaggerated or misplaced, or beyond rectification in the terms of this world. Then I could see what I'm actually dealing with. Theologically, that is a completely unacceptable notion. It just happened to cross my mind. I apologize for it. Since I am trying to tell the truth, there is one other thing. The edginess went out of his voice when he was talking with your mother. I would almost say he seemed to relax. He sounded like someone speaking with a friend. And so did she. I believe I am beginning to see where the grace is for me in this. I have prayed considerably, and I have slept a while too, and I feel I'm reaching some clarity. I have never been to St. Louis, a fact I now regret. I have been looking through these pages, and I realize that for some time I have mainly been worrying to myself, when my intention from the beginning was to speak to you. I meant to leave you a reasonably candid testament to my better self, and it seems to me now that what you must see here is just an old man struggling with the difficulty of understanding what it is he's struggling with. I believe I may have found a way out of the cave of this tedious preoccupation, however. It's worth a try. So, when I was sitting there on the porch last night, more or less feigning sleep, and your mother took my hand and held it in her hands, that was a great happiness to me. I see I did indicate this, her two warm hands, and I noted that at the same time she spoke of me much more kindly than I deserve. Only thinking back on it did I realize that she was speaking as if from that settled life she said she had always wanted, and as if it could not be lost to her, though in every practical material sense she knows it will be. That pleased me, too. Remembering when they said what they did about looking in windows and wondering about other people's lives made me feel companionable with them. I could have said, that's three of us, because, as the Lord knows, for many years I did exactly the same thing. But in that moment, the way she spoke, it seemed that all the wondering about life had been answered for her once and for all, and if that is true, it is wonderful. The notion is a source of peace for me. I had a dream once that Boughton and I were down at the river looking around in the shallows for something or other. When we were boys, it would have been tadpoles, and my grandfather stalked out of the trees in that furious way he had, scooped his hat full of water and threw it so a sheet of water came sailing toward us, billowing in the air like a veil, and fell down over us. Then he put his hat back on his head and stalked off into the trees again and left us standing there in that glistening river, amazed at ourselves and shining like the apostles. I mention this because it seems to me transformations just that abrupt do occur in this life, and they occur unsought and unawaited, and they beggar your hopes and your deserving. This came to my mind as I was reflecting on the day I first saw your mother, that blessed, rainy Pentecost. That morning, something began that felt to me as if my soul were being teased out of my body, and that's a fact. I have never told you how all that came about, how we came to be married, and I learned a great deal from the experience, believe me. It enlarged my understanding of hope, just to know that such a transformation can occur, and it has greatly sweetened my imagination of death, odd as that may sound. Even though I told myself I had hardly noticed her that first morning, I spent the whole next week hoping she would come back. I rebuked myself considerably for forgetting to ask her name as she went out the door, thinking about it in terms of my obligations to straying sheep and lost souls, which are expressions I never do use, even in my thoughts, and which I would certainly never have applied to her. One interesting aspect of the whole experience was that I simply could not be honest with myself, and I couldn't deceive myself either. It was terrible. I felt like such a fool. But you see, I was mindful of her youth and of my age, and I knew nothing about her, whether she might be married or not. So I couldn't admit to myself that I simply wanted to see her, to hear her voice again. She said, "Good morning, Reverend." That was all. But I remember trying to retain the sound of it, trying to hear it again in my mind. I'll tell you, if my grandfather did throw his mantle over me, so to speak, he did it long before I came into this world. The holiness of his life imputed a holiness to mine, or to my vocation, that I have tried to diminish as little as I could. I have tried to be careful of my reputation and also of my character. I have tried to keep the gospel before me as a standard for my life and my preaching. And yet there I was trying to write a sermon when all I really wanted to do was try to remember a young woman's face. If I had had this experience earlier in life, I would have been much wiser, much more compassionate. I really didn't understand what it was that made people who came to me so indifferent to good judgment, to common sense, or why they would say, "I know, I know," when I urged a little reasonableness on them, and why it meant, "It doesn't matter. I just don't care." That's what the saints and the martyrs say. And I know now that it is passion that moves them to their prodigal renunciations. I might seem to be comparing something great and holy with a minor and ordinary thing, that is, love of God with mortal love, but I just don't see them as separate things at all. If we can be divinely fed with a morsel and divinely blessed with a touch, then the terrible pleasure we find in a particular face can certainly instruct us in the nature of the very grandest love. I devoutly believe this to be true. I remember in those days loving God for the existence of love and being grateful to God for the existence of gratitude, right down in the depths of my misery. I realized many things I am at a loss to express. And of course, those feelings become milder with time, which is a mercy. Louisa and I were expected to marry almost from childhood, so nothing had prepared me to find myself thinking day and night about a complete stranger, a woman much too young, probably a married woman. That was the first time in my life I ever felt I could be snatched out of my character, my calling, my reputation, as if they could just fall away like a dry husk. I had never felt before that everything I thought I was amounted to the clothes on my back, and the books on my shelves, and the calendar I kept full of obligations waiting and obligations fulfilled. As I have said, it was a foretaste of death, or at least of dying. And why should that seem strange? Passion is the word we use, after all. Well, it got much worse. She was there every Sunday but one, and I wrote all those sermons, I confess, with the thought of pleasing her, impressing her. I struggled not to look at her too often or too long, but I would convince myself, nevertheless, that I saw disappointment of some kind in her face. And then I would spend the next week praying right down on my knees that she would give me another chance. I felt so ridiculous, but I would speak to the Lord about it just the same, asking him to strengthen me in exercising my pastoral responsibilities, and not a word I said was true, because I was really just a foolish old man, asking the Almighty to indulge his foolishness, and I knew it at the time. And my prayers were answered, beyond anything I could have thought to ask. A wife and a child. I would never have believed it. There was that one terrible Sunday she wasn't there. How dead and sad and airless that morning was. How shabby we all seemed, and the church, too. Of course, my sermon that day was about welcoming the stranger, because you might be welcoming an angel unawares. I hated reading it. I felt everyone in the room knew I was standing there making a confession of my folly. It seemed inevitable to me that she would never come back again. So I spent a dreadful week resigning myself to the smallness of my life, the drabness of it, and thanking the Lord that I had never made a complete fool of myself, had never held her by the hand at the door and attempted conversation, though I had rehearsed it in my mind what I might say to her, and had even written it out. It must be said also that I hated myself for a fool that I had not held her hand, had not spoken to her. I spent that week trying to make myself describe what it was that attracted me to her so strongly, somehow thinking that because I could not, the attraction would be dispelled. And I spent the week missing her, as if she were the only friend I ever had on earth. And I also gave some thought to the practical problem of learning her name and finding out where she lived, thinking to excuse this as a pastoral concern. What humiliation! The next Sunday, there she was again. I was miserable with relief, afraid I might laugh for no reason, afraid I might look at her too long, trying to remind myself she was a stranger, though she had been my dearest and most inward thought for weeks, and that I must not startle her with some unaccountable familiarity. I had been to the barber, and I was wearing a new shirt, since it seemed only prudent to suppose that my constant, passionate, and most unworthy prayers might be answered. And I'd made a little experiment with hair tonic. Boughton met me in the road, as he often did in those days, and he looked at me and chuckled, and I thought, "What an utter and transparent fool I am!" When she left the church that day, I did hold her hand, and I did say a few words. "We missed you last week. It's good to have you here again." "Oh," she said, and she blushed and looked away as if the kindness had surprised her, though it was only the most basic and routine preacherly kindness, that being all I felt I could allow myself under the circumstances. I am sick with love. That's scripture. It makes me laugh to remember this. I turned to the Bible in my crisis, as I have always done. And the text I chose was the Song of Songs. I might have learned from it that such miseries as mine were beautiful in the Lord's sight, if I had been younger, and if I had known that your mother was not a married woman. As it was, the beauty of the poems just hurt my feelings. Oh, but the next week I held her hand, and I told her we had a Bible study that met on Sunday night, and she would be most welcome. Then I went home and prayed that my wiliness would be rewarded, and shaved again, and tried to read until evening. I walked up early to the church, and there she was, waiting for me by the steps, hoping she might have a word with me. At that point I began to suspect, as I have from time to time, that grace has a grand laughter in it. She confided to this unworthy old swain with perfume in his hair that she came to me seeking baptism. No one seen to it for me when I was a child, she said. I've been feeling the lack of it. Oh, the sad, stark purity of her look. I said, Well, my dear, we will take care of you. And then, very conversationally, I asked her if she had a family in the area. She shook her head and said, very softly, I don't have family at all. I felt a surge of sadness for her, and still, in my wretched heart, I thanked the Lord. So I instructed your mother in the doctrines of the faith, and in due course I did indeed baptize her, and I became happily accustomed to the sight of her, a quiet presence, and I began to give thanks that I had lived through the worst of my passion without making a ruin and a desolation of my good name, without running after her in the street, as I nearly did once when I saw her step out of the grocery store and walk away. I scared myself so badly that time I broke into a sweat. That's how strong the impulse was. And I was 67! But I did always act consistently with my great respect for her youth and her loneliness. I can promise you that. I took great care about it. I thought it best to recruit some of the kindest older women to sit through her instruction with her. And I believe that made her shy about speaking, which I regretted very much. Two or three of the ladies had pronounced views on points of doctrine, particularly sin and damnation, which they never learned from me. I blame the radio for sowing a good deal of confusion where theology is concerned. And television is worse. You can spend 40 years teaching people to be awake to the fact of mystery. And then some fellow with no more theological sense than a jackrabbit gets himself a radio ministry and all your work is forgotten. I do wonder where it will end. But even that was for the best, because one of the ladies, Veda Dyer, got herself into a considerable excitement talking about flames, that is, perdition, so I felt obliged to take down the Institutes and read them a passage on the lot of the reprobate, about how their torments are figuratively expressed to us by physical things, unquenchable fire and so on, to express how wretched it is to be cut off from all fellowship with God. I have the passage in front of me. It is alarming, certainly, but it isn't ridiculous. I told them, if you want to inform yourselves as to the nature of hell, don't hold your hand in a candle flame, just ponder the meanest, most desolate place in your soul. They all did ponder a good deal, and I did too, listening to the evening wind and the cicadas. I came near alarming myself with the thought of the loneliness stretching ahead of me, and the new bitterness of it, and how I hated the secretiveness and the renunciation that honor and decency required of me, and that common sense enforced on me. But when I looked up, your mother was watching me, smiling a little, and she touched my hand, and she said, You'll be just fine. How soft her voice is! That there should be such a voice in the whole world, and that I should be the one to hear it, seemed to me then, and seems to me now, an unfathomable grace. She began to come to the house when some of the other women did, to take the curtains away to wash, to defrost the icebox, and then she started coming by herself to tend the gardens. She made them very fine and prosperous, and one evening when I saw her there, out by the wonderful roses, I said, How can I repay you for all this? And she said, You ought to marry me. And I did. Here is my thought. If I were to put my hand on her brow and bless her purely, as if I were indeed and altogether a minister of the Lord, I would hope just such an experience for her as that one of mine. Oh, I know she is fond of me and very loyal, but I could hope that sometime the Song of Songs would startle her, as if it spoke from her own heart. I cannot really make myself believe that her feelings could have been at all like mine. And why do I worry so much over this Jack Boughton? Love is holy because it is like grace. The worthiness of its object is never really what matters. I might well be leaving her to a greater happiness than I have given her, even granting every difficulty. Sometimes I think I have seen the beginnings of it in her. If the Lord is letting me momentarily be witness to a grace he intends for her, I should find in this a great kindness toward myself. This morning, a splendid dawn passed over our house on its way to Kansas. This morning, Kansas rolled out of its sleep into a sunlight grandly announced, proclaimed throughout heaven, one more of the very finite number of days that this old prairie has been called Kansas or Iowa. But it has all been one day, the first day. Light is constant. We just turn over in it. So every day is, in fact, the self-same evening and morning. My grandfather's grave turned into the light, and the dew on his weedy little mortality patch was glorious. Thou wast in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, the topaz, and the diamond. While I'm thinking of it, when you are an old man like I am, you might think of writing some sort of account of yourself, as I am doing. In my experience of it, age has a tendency to make one's sense of oneself harder to maintain, less robust in some ways. Why do I love the thought of you old? That first twinge of arthritis in your knee is a thing I imagine with all the tenderness I felt when you showed me your loose tooth. Be diligent in your prayers, old man. I hope you will have seen more of the world than I ever got around to seeing. Only myself to blame. And I hope you will have read some of my books. And God bless your eyes, and your hearing also, and of course your heart. I wish I could help you carry the weight of many years. But the Lord will have that fatherly satisfaction. This has been a strange day, disturbing. Glory called and invited you and your mother to the movies. Then, when she came for you, she had old Boughton with her. And she helped him out of the car and up the walk and up the steps. He so rarely leaves his house now that I was really amazed to find him at my door. We sat down at the kitchen table and gave him a glass of water, and then the three of you left. All the bother seemed to have worn him out, because he just sat there with a more or less sociable expression, but with his eyes closed, clearing his throat from time to time as if he was about to speak, but then thought better of it. I found something on the radio, and we listened a while to that. He'd chuckle a little if anything interesting happened. I believe he had been there most of an hour before he started to speak. Then he said, "You know, Jack's not right with himself yet. Still not right." And he shook his head. I said, "We've talked about that." "Oh, yes, he talks," Boughton said. "But he's never told me why he's come back here. Never told Glory, either. He was supposed to have some kind of job down in St. Louis. I don't know what's become of that. We thought he might be married. I believe he was for a while. I don't know what became of that, either. He seems to have a little money." "I don't know anything about it," he said. "I know he talks to you and Mrs. Ames. I know that." Then he closed his eyes again. The effort of speaking seemed to have been considerable, and I think it was because he hated to have to say what he had just said. I took it as a warning. I don't know another way to look at it. And I took his coming to the house as a way of underscoring his words, as it certainly did. And now I am persuaded again that I must speak to your mother. Young Boughton came walking up the porch steps while we were still sitting there. I said, "Come in," and pushed a chair out for him. But he stood by the door for a minute or two, taking us in and drawing conclusions, which were pretty near the mark, as I could see by his expression. He seems always to suspect that people are in some sort of league against him. And no doubt that's true often enough, just as it was true at that moment. And there is an element of frustration and embarrassment in his manner when he looks past the pretense, as he seems always to do, that makes me feel ashamed to be a part of it, and sorry for him, too. There is also anger, and that concerns me. Jack said, I came home and there was no one there. It was a bit of a shock. Boughton said, in that hearty voice he can still muster when he wants to sound as though he's telling the truth. I'm sorry, Jack. Ames and I have been looking after each other while the women are out at the movies. We thought you would be gone a little longer. Yes, well, no harm done, he said. And he sat down when I asked him to again. And he kept his eyes on me with that half-smile he has when he wants you to know he knows what's really going on, and he can't quite believe you persist in trying to fool him. Boughton sort of nodded off then, as he does when conversations get difficult, and I can't blame him, though I do have my heart to consider, too, because it was a considerable strain on me to think what to say to Jack, as it always is, and always has been, it seems to me. I felt sorry for him, and that's a fact. It seems almost a curse to me the way he can see through people. Of course, I couldn't be honest with him, so there I was, being dishonest with him, and there he was watching me as if I were the worst liar in the world, as if I were insulting him, as I suppose, in fact, I was. Your father felt like he needed to get out of the house, I said. He said, understandable. In fact, that was a ridiculous thing for me to have said, considering that it's about all Boughton can do to walk from his bed to the chair on the porch. I said, I suppose he wanted to take advantage of the good weather while it lasts. I'm sure he did. Well, I said after a minute, this is some year for acorns, which was perfectly pitiful. Jack laughed outright. The crows have made an impressive showing, he said, and the gourds are particularly shapely and abundant, I think. And all that time he was looking at me as if to say, let's just be honest with each other for 5 minutes. Now, I excuse myself in that I don't know what the truth actually is. I do believe his father came here to, in effect, warn me about him, but I am not absolutely certain of it. And in any case, I can hardly betray a confidence, especially not one as inflammatory and injurious as that one. Certainly not with poor old Boughton sitting there 3 feet from me, quite probably listening to the whole conversation. But dishonesty is dishonesty, a humiliating thing to be caught at, especially when you have no choice but to persist in it and to salvage as much of the deception as you can under the very eye of indignation, so to speak. On the other hand, as an old man, his father's senior by a couple of years despite my relative vigor, such as it is, I feel I have the right not to be deviled in this way. If the point was to make me angry, I am angry as I write this. My heart is up to something that is alarming the rest of my body, in fact. I must go pray. I wonder what he knows about my heart. Well, of course, he must know a good deal about my heart, since your mother did enlist him in bringing my study downstairs. When I pray about all this, it is a sense of the sadness in him that keeps coming to my mind. He is someone who must be forgiven a great deal, on the grounds of that strange suffering. And when the three of you came back, which you did fairly soon, things were much better. Glory seemed a little startled at first at finding Jack there, but your mother was pleased to see him, as she always is, I believe. You liked the movie. Tobias isn't allowed to go to movies, so you brought him almost half your box of Cracker Jacks, which I thought was decent of you. I wonder whether you should go to movies. But with television in the house, there seems no point in forbidding them. Of course, Tobias can't watch television either. Your mother promised his mother we'd see to that whenever he comes over, which is often enough to make you miss the Cisco Kid a lot more frequently than you would like. You're not the most sociable child in the world, and I'm a little afraid that, given a choice, Tobias or television, your best chum would be on his own. As it is, he spends more time waiting on the porch than he should. From time to time, you have seemed so lonely to us, and here is Tobias, an estimable chap, an answer to our prayers, and you let him sit on the porch until some cartoon is over. But I'm not inclined to do much forbidding these days. T's father is young. He has years and years with his boys, God willing. Well, the three of you came in, pleased with yourselves and smelling of popcorn, and I was so relieved I can't tell you. Then, after a little talk, your mother and Glory helped Boughton out to the car and took him home, which is the only place he is comfortable anymore. And then they made a supper for us all to have there. You went off to find Tobias so you could contaminate his good Lutheran mind with nonsense about gunslingers and federal marshals, and I sat there at the table with Jack Boughton, who didn't say a word. He just took a little time deciding to leave. He didn't come back to his father's house for dinner, and nobody said anything about it, but I know it worried us all. Your mother and Glory took a walk after the table was cleared. To enjoy the evening, they said. But when they came back, Glory said they had seen Jack, and he had told them he would come home later. I could tell they had found him down at the bar. They didn't offer particulars, and Boughton didn't ask. Jack Boughton has a wife and a child. He showed me a picture of him. He only let me see it for half a minute, and then he took it back. I was slightly at a loss, which he must have expected, and still I could tell it was an effort for him not to take offense. You see, the wife is a colored woman. That did surprise me. I was over at the church yesterday morning, in my study, sorting through some old papers, thinking if I put aside the interesting ones, the actual records, they might not be discarded along with all the clutter. There are just boxes and boxes of memoranda and magazine articles and flyers and utility bills. It seems as if I never threw anything away. I'm afraid a new minister might not be patient enough to sort through it all, and that would be my fault. Well, there I was, feeling a little dirty and cobwebby, and also a little morose, and, I must say, dreading interruption, too, since I may at any time stop feeling up to this sort of thing. I hadn't been at it half an hour, and I was tired already. And in came Jack Boughton, once again wearing the suit and necktie, once again kempt and shaved, but looking a little frayed for all that, weary about the eyes, God bless him. I was interested to see him, more interested than pleased, I admit. I couldn't very well talk to him with dirt all over my face and hands, so I excused myself to go wash, and when I came back, he was still standing by the door. I'd forgotten to offer him a chair, so he was just standing there. He was looking quite pale, and I was ashamed of myself for my thoughtlessness. But he is so afraid of offending unintentionally that he abides by manners most people forget as soon as they learn them, and that can make it seem almost as if he means to make you ashamed. That is how I felt, at least, and I know it was unfair of me. Then when he sat down, I went to lift some boxes from my desk, and he stood up and took one of them right out of my hands, which was good of him, but irked me a little just the same. I'd rather drop dead doing for myself than add a day to my life by acting helpless. But he meant well. He moved both boxes onto the floor, and then his hands were grimy and the front of his jacket. So he took out his handkerchief and wiped himself down a little. I suggested we go into the sanctuary, but he said the office was fine for him. So we sat there, quiet, for a while. Then he said, "I stayed away from this town for a long time, as a courtesy to my father, mainly. I might never have come back." I asked him what had made him change his mind. It took him a while to answer. For several reasons, I felt I needed to speak with him, my father. "But," he said, "somehow when I came here, I didn't expect him to be so very old. The last few years have been hard on him." He put his hand to his eyes. I said, "It has done him good to have you here." He shook his head. "You talked with him yesterday. Yes, he did seem a little worried about you. He laughed. A few days ago, Glory said to me, he's fragile, we don't want to kill him. We. It's true, though, I don't want to kill him. So I thought I might be able to speak with you. This will be my last attempt, I promise. I almost reminded him my own health is not perfect, which would have been foolish, since on second thought, I could not really imagine that any revelation he might make would strike me down. He took a little leather case out of his breast pocket and opened it and held it in front of me. His hand was not steady, and I had to put on my reading glasses, but then I could see it fairly well. It was posed like a portrait photograph, himself, a young woman, and a boy about 5 or 6. The woman was seated in a chair with the child standing next to her, and young Boughton was standing behind them. It was Jack Boughton, a colored woman, and a light-skinned colored boy. Boughton looked at the picture, and then he snapped the case shut and slipped it back into his pocket. He said, "You see?" And his voice was so controlled it sounded bitter. "You see, I also have a wife and child." Then he just watched me for a minute or two, clearly hoping he would not have to take offense. "That's a fine-looking family," I said. He nodded. "She's a fine woman. He's a fine boy. I'm a lucky man." He smiled. "And you're afraid this might kill your father?" He shrugged. "It came near enough killing her father and her mother. They cursed the day I was born." He laughed and touched his hand to his face. "As you know, I have considerable experience antagonizing people, but this is on another level entirely." I was thinking my own thoughts, so he said, "Maybe not. Maybe that's just how it seems to me." And then he sat there studying his hands. So I said, "Well, how long have you been married?" And regretted the question. He cleared his throat. "We are married in the eyes of God, as they say, who does not provide a certificate, but who also does not enforce anti-miscegenation laws. The Deus absconditus at his most benign." "Sorry." He smiled. "In the eyes of God, we have been man and wife for about 8 years. We have lived as man and wife a total of 17 months, 2 weeks and a day." I remarked that we have never had those laws here in Iowa, and he said, "Yes, Iowa, the shining star of radicalism." So I asked him if he came here to be married. He shook his head. "Her father doesn't want her to marry me. Her father is also a minister, by the way. I suppose that was inevitable. And there is a good Christian man down there in Tennessee, a friend of the family, who is willing to marry my wife and adopt my son. They think this is very kind of him. I suppose it is. They believe it would be best for everybody," he said. "And the fact is, I have had considerable difficulty looking after my family. From time to time they have gone back to Tennessee when things were too difficult. That's where they are now." He said, "I can't really ask her to make a final break with her family under the circumstances." He cleared his throat. We were just quiet. Then he said, "You know, the chief thing her father has against me, he takes me for an atheist. Della says he thinks all white men are atheists. The only difference is that some of them are aware of it. Della is my wife." I said, "Well, from certain things you have said, I have gotten the impression that you are an atheist." He nodded. "It is probably truer to say I am in a state of categorical unbelief."